Today we talk infidelity off the back of new research published in Sexual and Relationship Therapy and how men and women perceive infidelity. We're also going to be discussing some new waves in mental health and treating depression, as well as looking at raising a child. Now, we want to raise a child that is full of self-esteem, but are we concerned about raising a narcissist? So that's something we'll be discussing later on. A big welcome back to Dr. Raymond. Hello.
Hi.
It's good to see you again.
It's nice to be back again.
Yes.
It's a coincidence that I'm here, but I'm glad to have an opportunity to be back and enjoy being on the show with you. Thank you.
Well, it's lovely to have you here. And of course, do take advantage of Dr. Raymond. He's here for the next 2 hours, here to help you with issues you might be facing in your daily life when it comes to depression, mood disorders, relationship issues for you or a loved one, or indeed a colleague or friend. So, Dr. Raymond, let's start with this research. It's been published in this document, Sexual and Relationship Therapy, and it's looking at ways men and women perceive infidelity. So it's very much looking at gender and how men and women are different and how they perceive or define what infidelity is.
Well, infidelity is the act of unfaithfulness during a romantic relationship. It's associated with a lot of emotional distress, and these can be feelings of betrayal, jealousy, anxiety, as well as depression. Now, men and women will perceive these not so much differently in the definition, but in the way that they will react to the situation. And it has to do also with personality. You know, not all women are alike, not all men are alike. Men tend to be more physical in their components of understanding it. Women tend to be more emotional. But what's interesting is how they perceive each other. What's also a determining factor is how you define infidelity. There are some people who believe it as completely out of the picture. It will not be part of the relationship. Both men and women feel that way. And then other people say, well, it's part of life. And these things happen, and I've even heard women who'd say, well, men do this. Well, it's not men do this. Women do that too, obviously. But women sometimes suspect that men will be unfaithful, and it's okay because he's a man. Well, that's not true. That's not even an explanation. Forget it about being an excuse. So what happens then in that definition, she'll say, well, he can go out wherever he wants as long as he comes back to me. Now, that's an extreme case. The other case is where some people have such jealousy that they're afraid of losing that partner to somebody else because of their own insecurities. So a lot of people associate this with women. But men can also be quite jealous. So the definition of infidelity is universal as far as meaning betrayal within a relationship or having a partner outside of the relationship. But then your perception of that will determine how you deal with it and also how you're going to resolve it. Many times people come for marriage therapy because of a betrayal or deception. And sometimes it's not physical, the sexual betrayal. Sometimes it's an emotional betrayal. That also plays a difference in perception as well. Some people are more sensitive to the emotional than they are to the physical, and vice versa. But what we find is that infidelity is not the reason for a divorce. Usually infidelity is because there's a problem in the marriage, and that opens up the door to deal with those issues. That's where the marriage will either survive or the marriage will dissolve.
Well, looking at these findings and the idea that we perceive infidelity in different ways, and it's exactly what you're saying there. There's the emotional, there's the physical, and even down to things like, you know, if your partner is corresponding with somebody of the opposite sex via social media or via text messages, do you deem that to be an infidelity, a betrayal? So we're going to be exploring that. And looking here at this study, the research, 354 undergraduate psychology students completed an online questionnaire which aimed to assess their personality and how this related to their perceptions of infidelity and their sensitivity to rejection, which I think is also an interesting area. And through this questionnaire, there were categories that were questioned, categories of infidelity in three ways. So the physical infidelity, intimate infidelity, and fantasy infidelity. So when we come back, we'll break down those three categories to understand better our relationships and what we're sensitive to, what we will accept, what we won't accept, what we'll forgive or not forgive, and if we can recover if somebody, if not just somebody, but your partner crosses the line for you. We're starting off today discussing infidelity off the back of this report, new research showing after a survey with 354 undergraduate psychology students about personality, gender, and how we perceive infidelity and how sensitive we might be to the idea of rejection. So what do you think about that? What do you perceive to be infidelity? What could you forgive? What could you not forgive? And it's interesting looking at the definition of infidelity. So marital disloyalty, adultery, unfaithfulness, disloyalty. So there is a spectrum, really, when we use that word infidelity. Now, Dr. Raymond, if we're looking at the way this questionnaire was broken down into categories, so the physical infidelity, intimate infidelity, and fantasy infidelity.
Yeah, the physical is obvious. That's where you have all the physical intimacy going on. Emotionals tend to be more of a threat to a lot of people because it's not as tangible. And the concern is who's going to be threatened by it. Now, what's interesting is men tend to be more concerned about their partner, a female partner, that is, involved sexually with another person. That's the biggest threat for them. Women tend to be more concerned about the emotional threat of having their partner emotionally involved with someone else, because women will perceive that as leading to a physical. Where men get it wrong, men actually think that women who start off physical will lead to emotional. It's actually women to get to the physical have to have the emotion in the first place. Most women, that is. That's how we take the research and put it into practice, what really applies from the research and how does it really work in practice. Now, the fantasy section is quite interesting. This is something that's coming out quite new over the last several years, especially with pornography, the internet system, being able to chat, going on even telephone calls with someone who you're not really sure what they really look like, but the picture was interesting. And that in itself, for some people, is a way of saying, I've lost my partner. He's interested in something that's not even animated. It's not even real. It's a person who's at a distance, if they're even there, or maybe it's a recording. What's wrong with this person? And usually it's the man who gets into pornography. Now, some women do. Also, what we find is that on a healthy side of that, when people get much older and they want to continue to engage in the physical aspect of their relationship, what we know with aging process, there needs to be more mental and physical stimulation. So sometimes mutual viewing of pornography, a husband and a wife, will actually help stimulate them to reach the point of their own intimacy. The reason that's okay is because they both agree to that. That's part of their definition, and they've grown into that process. Now, not everybody needs that. Some people will, however. But when we look at the damage that's done by betrayal and deception, it's a third degree devastation. What we see is a major loss that takes place in the relationship, because the foundation of a strong relationship is trust and respect. Well, that trust and respect is what builds into what we call love, which is not an emotion. It's a learned attitude. And that's the intimacy and the friendship part. In between that trust and respect and that intimacy and friendship is that vulnerability. Well, you can destroy that with betrayal. Because when we have a loss in a relationship, that could be through death. And that's one of the easiest things to deal with. A breakup because of just irreconcilable differences, that's more difficult. But when it's deception, when it's betrayal, that creates a completely different, wider range of animalistic problems that are going to go on here. The person begins not only to question the partner who betrayed, but themselves. Now, can they live with that? And they'll maybe want to work on it. They may want to improve their marriage, but what they're really wanting to improve is themselves. What happened in this relationship that I got to where I am? That's usually what people get to. Once they've gotten to that understanding, they might say, you know what? even though my partner's made all the corrections, I can't complain about him or her. I don't want to be there anymore. There's too much water under the bridge.
Mm.
And I'm ready to move on with my new understanding of my new self.
The words deception, betrayal, to understand that in a relationship is where, you know, there's been secrets or there's been your understanding of what your relationship is and you learn it to be something else that you didn't realize. Lies, when you've been told one thing and actually your partner is doing something else. They're just some of the what conjures up in my mind when we use those terms. So to deal with that. Now, healing after my husband's affair. This is a blog written by a lady. My husband cheated after 3 children and over 10 years of marriage. We were happy, and I hope we will share that happiness again. Now, to give you some background on this woman's story, I discovered the truth on September the 22nd, 2012. I guess the truth had been haunting me despite a happy marriage and 3 amazing children. There was something wrong. Funny thing is, I thought I was unhappy with my job or something. No idea that the root of my unhappiness, discontent, and insecurity was stemming from my seemingly perfect marriage. But there I was at 2 a.m. going through his emails, trying to find something, and then I saw the email to her that read, "I miss you." Why would he tell another woman he missed her? And why did he email her a photograph of my children? And why was her comment that it wasn't like the other photos they'd been sharing? And why was there no other photos in his email to or from her? So my heart was pounding and my body was shaking, and then I found it. A photograph, explicit, downloaded from Tumblr and emailed to another account. They had private accounts. I realized this. It took me less than 2 minutes to hack into the account, and as my computer screen refreshed, I prayed that all I would find was a collection of erotic photographs, but it wasn't. I found 73 pages of emails from her to my husband detailing a year-long affair. I wanted to scream, but it was the middle of the night. My husband was away for the weekend with one of our children. I couldn't even scream at him. I sobbed in my bed alone, wondering how and why we got to this point. So let's stop there and just where we're at in this story, Dr. Raymond. Interesting, as she talks about, I knew I wasn't feeling completely happy. I knew there was discontentment, but I thought it was to do with my job. I didn't realize it was to do with our marriage. And yet something led her to want to start looking through emails, looking for something to do with her husband.
That's interesting, but not unusual. Many times people get lost in something else other than the marriage. And they think this is a normal thing to do. And when we look at the marriage map, we see that the first couple of years are fantasy, they're honeymoon, everything's fine, nothing will ever go wrong. And everything starts off as a perfect relationship. When it doesn't stay perfect, it's because when they stop being married. In other words, usually children come into the picture, and they start being parents more than they are husband and wife. This is a normal process. What happens, however, they forget about each other, they forget to date, they forget to share. They become so overwhelmed with the responsibilities of being the caretakers for what they believe is the product of their union. Their union doesn't stay there because of that product. And they start to separate, they start to lose communications, even to the point where they forget to sometimes ask, "How are you doing? The children need this today, can you drive them there?" Or, "The children haven't eaten and I'm going to be late for work. Can you fix dinner for them?" Well, these instructional kinds of things are not really a marriage. It is parenting, but it's not a marriage. And what people realize is that you will have 2 relationships. One is being mom and dad, but there's also the husband and wife. What parents will many times think is, "I've got to devote my life to my children because my children need us. And if we're not doing that, we're neglecting the children." Well, frankly, the opposite is true. When children see that mom and dad are also husband and wife, that they're enjoying their own romantic relationship, they go in out to movies, even if they leave us with a babysitter, the children will feel more secure in your parenting because the husband and wife theirs is there as well. What we see lots of times is children who are brought to the clinic because they're nervous, whatever that means, stressed out, anxious, depressed, is because they're not seeing the husband and wife thing with mom and dad, which is the foundation of their family existence. They have no complaints about dad being a great dad, mom being a great mom, but but they're not seeing them dating. They're not seeing them enjoying each other. That for them becomes scary. That for them becomes nerve-wracking. What we also see is children, about 2 years before a divorce becomes a topic, were already starting to act up and act out, especially around this age of 6, 7, and 8 years old. Now, these come from the California Study on Children of Divorce from years ago, and new studies are still showing very, very similar things. So history is repeating itself. The same pattern repeats itself from family to family. But what's interesting, the manifestations are much, much more clear today. 3 generations ago, divorce was not a vocabulary word. 2 generations ago, it was a consideration. 1 generation ago, it was faddish. Get married for as long as you want, get a divorce, move on. Now, a lot of people can blame these on the soap operas of 1960, where people were wondering, why is my life not as exciting as Rachel? You know, Rachel is still there. She's a grandmother. Now her grandchildren are going through the same problem on that, whatever that show was called, As the Stomach Turns, or I can't remember some of the names of these shows. You know, and today we're also seeing very similar situations with media. Now, I'm not anti-media, of course. What I am having difficulty with is parents who don't monitor what their children are watching. And we're seeing a lot more non-commitment behavior from certain aspects of television, the movies, even PlayStation situations that are vulgarity, not just profanity, but aggression and sexuality.
Some might even say with social media that it's breeding this feeling of discontent, that you're missing out, that there's more out there, that, you know, you're able to connect with people, as you said earlier, whether you know them or not, creates a fantasy world that takes you somewhere. It's escapism. And looking at the national newspaper in August of 2015, so just a year ago, blaming social media for divorce is short-sighted. So we'll explore that when we come back. I want to ask Dr. Raymond about this woman with her blog, Healing After My Husband's Affair. Was she right to go looking through emails and checking her husband's phone? What do you think? Let me know. Talking with Dr. Raymond Hamdan today. He's a clinical and forensic psychologist based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics, dividing his time between the United States and the UAE and across the globe. You are passing through, staying for a few days as you're traveling on business that we can't discuss, I'm sure. But it's always great to have you stop by.
It has
by.
Nothing to do with infidelity, by the way. I just want to make sure that one is clear.
No, I was thinking more on your forensic side of what you do at profession.
It.
Yes, exactly.
Course.
Depression, symptoms of depression, mood disorders, relationship issues, things like that. And with a great career and so many people have come through the doors and so many people you have helped along the way, Dr. Raymond. How many years now,
well,
your career?
I've been practicing since 73, but been in the UAE since 1990. And I think our files are more than 20,000 now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we've got to meet a lot of wonderful people and gotten to work with a lot of amazing individuals. And it's brilliant to have part in people's lives. I really am glad that a lot of people allow us to be part of their life and move forward. And it is confidential. You know, so people have the realization that it's not going to be broadcast. So even if we speak in general, some people say, oh my goodness, he's talking about my case. Well, we're not talking about you or your case. We're talking in general. And that's because a lot of people have similar situations. Even though they're similar situations, everybody is unique. Everybody is different. Whether it's everybody has a different depression, but according to the guidelines, we know what depression is. We know how to define it, how to diagnose it, how to assess it to know what kind of depression it is. But yet people are quite unique. With medicine changing and advancing, psychology advancing and changing, it's always keeping up the research, and the people that we meet are benefiting from that. And we benefit from learning from people. Like sometimes the best diagnostician is actually the patient. You just have to learn to listen to them and not just having them run into your office for 5 minutes and asking a bunch of questions and then leave. You got to spend time with people. They're going to be the most helpful in understanding themselves. So after all these years, I've actually learned to help myself as well. You know, so we learn from each other in the process.
It's so true. It's the same doing this show as well. I learn so much from people like yourself, from guests, from the listeners. So it is two-way traffic, isn't it? It's a two-way street. We're talking about infidelity in the first hour today as we are looking at this report, a new research published in Sexual and Relationship Therapy, and covering the different ways in which men and women perceive infidelity. So it may not be a great surprise to see that women are coming up in this study as being more sensitive, but that's also because women come higher in their sense of needing communion, needing a sense of emotional attachment as well as physical attachment. So maybe nothing so new there, but it is interesting as times are changing when we're looking at society and what is available to us, and with the internet, with social media, with our ways of communicating, which are so far more sophisticated and varied, which is a great thing. But it also opens up channels of where maybe deception or betrayal or infidelity may take place. We're asking you today, how do you define infidelity? And that's across the spectrum of what you deem to be acceptable or not acceptable in your relationship. So, for example, if you were to find out your partner was corresponding with a member of the opposite sex, albeit platonic, would that be all right with you? If they hadn't told you about it, if you found out about it, how much do you need to know about your partner? Do you feel that you need to know everything? Now, in the case of the lady that has her own blog, Healing After My Husband's Affair, she outlines what happened to her in 2012 when she discovered that her husband was having an affair. She went looking on the internet, she was looking at emails, she was looking on his phone to find any signs of what might be going on. And I'm asking, well, I'll ask you, Dr. Remen, was it right for her to do that? Is it okay for us to be looking at our partner's email or looking at their internet history?
From a psychological angle, absolutely. And the reason I would say absolutely is because she was already sensing something was wrong, and she needed to get closure on that. And it's also what I tell parents. Definitely go through your children's drawers. Definitely look at their emails. Definitely see what they have in the car. You need to be able to monitor these kind of things. Well, in a relationship, she didn't just coincidentally decide, I'm going to go through my husband's emails. She was sensing that there was something wrong beyond the fact that she's busy at her work, he's busy at his work, and the only connection they have is the children. She was sensing something now. We're beginning now in psychology to understand that sixth sense. There's become now research that can actually measure that sixth sense, which indicates that people can, many times, not understand why they're sensing something. And sensing could be a thought, it could be a feeling, it could be a dream that they've had. Now, I'm not saying that every time you have a dream or a bad thought about your partner, there's something there. That's not what I'm saying at all. So I want to make sure that you understand that just because you have these feelings could be your own projection, your own insecurities, not the other person's reality. But for her, the way she described the situation as you read it, she was thinking there might be something going on, and I need to get closure on this. In that case, they are husband and wife. She deserves that closure. If she's not going to ask him, which would have been the preferred thing to do, then she needs to investigate. Now, of course, in a courtroom, there's going to be a lot of disagreement with that. In a courtroom, they might even question whether a parent has the right to look at the child's email. Well, frankly, as a psychologist, I think that you have to do that. You got to monitor. Whenever there's something there, or you think there's something there, you need to get closure on it.
Well, is it not right to speak to them first, or it's okay to do that when you've not had a conversation about this?
It's more appropriate to speak to them first. That would be the ethical protocol, the code of etiquette, to speak to them first. But usually when people are having an affair, they're going to lie about it. So if she senses that there's a lie, then she would investigate it anyway. Now, I'm not certainly taking up for what she did, but I'm indicating that from a psychological angle and as a practicing psychologist, I would not encourage it, but I wouldn't say you can't do it. You need to get closure. And this is an open door for problems that might be there that have not been talked about yet. Here's what my concern is, Suzanne. We're seeing a lot of people in the world today that are exploiting this situation. They're opening up opportunities for people to have affairs. They're opening up opportunities to meet people who are married. And from the stories that I've heard, it's horrendous. How many people go into particular sites and realize that their neighbors or people that they know at work are part of this package that your spouse is not supposed to know about? Now, why is it that your spouse might not be part of this? You might discover that they're actually part of it as well. You know, where is it that the option is? Where is it that moral, ethical living has been lost? Why is it that we're going in these directions as a majority of people, or maybe not a majority, I don't know the exact numbers, but why is it that we're looking at that? Why not an option of looking how to love each other again? How to date each other again? Why not have an affair with your spouse, not somebody else's?
Well, it's interesting you say this, because in this story, it's a similar story in a way, in that the husband goes on to explain, after the wife has read through the emails and seen the detail of their physical affair, the emotional affair, what he says is, she was a colleague at work. In fact, I've introduced you to her. You didn't seem to like her, so I stopped talking about her. But she was going through a hard time. And one thing led to another, and it was almost like I didn't even realize the road I was going down. And yet, of course, he must have done, because he made a decision at some point to take this relationship, friendship, work colleague situation to another level. But he actually talks about, and she says, we talked and talked, and this, she's written this 35 days after discovering the affair, and she says, for 35 days we've talked and talked and talked. And what he says is that he loves his wife, he loves his family, he got himself into something that he didn't know how to stop. And you know, everyone's different, everyone has their own perception, and we can make judgments. But ultimately, she's saying, I believe him, I love him, I think we can get over this. He's saying he wants to, but she wonders, is it just the fear factor, when he realised that she said to him, it's her or me and the kids. And that seemed to be the turning point.
A lot of people address this differently, and some people have the kind of personality they think they have to threaten the other person to bring them around, not realizing that those threats actually push them away further. The reason that people may be in a relationship outside of their marriage is because there's something that's not there in the marriage for them. Now, that doesn't mean that they're correct for doing that. That doesn't mean that they're mature. That doesn't mean that they have the right to have committed adultery. Whether it's adultery that's physical, emotional, or fantasy. The whole process here has nothing to do whether it's physical, emotional, or fantasy. It has to do with having to lie. If you're doing something you cannot tell your partner about, you got to ask yourself, what the hell am I doing? What's going on with this relationship that I cannot tell my partner? It may be that your partner is difficult. It might be that your partner is hysterical. They get too nervous about everything. They exaggerate everything. Well, you know what? If that's the case, you chose to marry that person. You help them get over that. You don't need to go lie about it. You don't need to come up with an excuse to have an affair by making your partner upset. Say, see how that person's behaving? Now I have the right to go out and do this. You know, this is unfortunately what we see a lot of, and this is why people come to us. But then people don't go to psychologists or lawyers because everything is good.
Yeah.
It's because there are problems. So in the process of understanding yourself and why you're reacting is more important than why did your partner do what they did, or why am I doing what I'm doing? Ask yourself, what is going on that I cannot tell my partner that she is my friend or he is my friend? In this process, always being transparent is the best situation. People might say, oh my gosh, my partner is going to be really upset if they know that a person of the opposite sex is a good friend of mine. But you know, if you do open up to your partner, say, there's this person that I met at work who's absolutely amazing. I really wish we could become friends with him or her and their partner. Or if he's single, he'd really be a fun guy. Maybe we'd go fishing together. Or maybe we could go out to a movie together and have coffee afterwards. You know, doing that certainly does open up a lot of communication between you and your partner. It certainly does bring in an acceptable dimension into the relationship. There's nothing wrong with having friends. There's nothing wrong with having friends of the opposite sex. But when you have to make it a secret, that's when you get to be vulnerable. That's when the marriage is at risk. And therefore, a lot of people are going to get hurt many times for nothing.
We'll explore that many times for nothing when we come back and take a look at this article in The National from last year. Blaming social media for divorce is short-sighted. Exploring, as you just outlined, Dr. Raymond, there are many different avenues for people to go down where they may be conscious or not consciously getting themselves into tricky waters when it comes to relationships. And you could be hurting your partner without even meaning to. So what is it for you? What's that line once crossed would be the deal breaker or would be the hurt or pain, the betrayal that you would find it difficult to recover from? Let us know your thoughts. So on the topic of infidelity and or whether you would look through your partner's phone or emails or internet history if you had a feeling something wasn't right in the relationship, Carrie's saying, surely it just shows that you're betraying trust if you feel that you have to look through their personal belongings. Well, it's a circle, isn't it? It feels like you feel there's something wrong, you check out their, you know, phone or whatever, and then they can accuse you of being mistrustful. But yes, you are mistrustful, and there's a reason why you're mistrustful. And it's about both people being honest about that, which isn't easy, Dr. Raymond.
Yeah, you need to find out what the cause is. And people aren't usually going to betray in a relationship unless there is a problem in the marriage. Now, that, again, is an explanation, not an excuse. So this is a discovery opportunity. It's a time to open up, to find out what's been happening in the relationship. You know, it might be that the partner says things and does things, and when you try to comment on it, they reject what you're saying. They don't want to hear it. So you feel like you're not being validated. Do you feel that anything that you wish to express is not going to be respected? But they can do anything that they want. You just can't do what you want. There's also abusive relationships in which people don't realize that they are abusive. And it could be the tone of voice that's used, the choice of wording. Some people have anger management issues. And sometimes the anger management is because they get so upset, the adrenaline goes up so high, it blocks out any of their rational, logical behavior. And they'll do things that they don't know they're doing until they calm down and people told them, you actually hit that person, or you broke the wall, or you tore paper up, or you threw the glass across the room. And they won't remember having done that until they've calmed down and were told what they had done. So these kind of things can come into the picture, and it could be something just as subtle as you don't give me eye contact. We don't speak to each other. The television is always on. Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with television, but limit it. And also, there's nothing wrong with social media. There's nothing wrong with PlayStation and these other things. I'm not trying to advertise for one company or another. I just don't know how to describe it any more generally. But there has to be limits, and there needs to be a balance. You don't spend 8 hours a day with your children on some game just because you don't want to have to deal with your kids. You know, go out, play ball, whether it's basketball or baseball. You know, even though you don't have to, cut the grass anyway. Wash the car, just for having experience of it with your kids. You know, go for a walk in the park. You know, throw a frisbee. Do things that are engaging other than getting stuck on things that has nothing to do with interaction. And this is where we see a lot of marriages suffer as well. They begin to separate unwittingly, unknowingly, until each one now has their own agenda, they have their own lives, and they're no longer connected as husband and wife. And as the children go older, they're no longer connected as mom and dad either, because the children are now independent. So we're not looking at blaming objects or instruments or situations. We're looking at helping people realize how they can stay connected. Watch television, but stay connected. Listen to the radio, but stay connected. Discuss the things you're listening to or that you're watching. You know,
but enjoy. Raymond, you know, you say all of those things, you're absolutely right, but surely the most key intrusion or third person in a marriage or relationship these days is the mobile phone, the smartphone. I see it in restaurants. I'm probably a culprit of this myself, where you're with friends, you're with your partner, and you're both sitting looking at your phones and not actually talking to each other. The smartphone is such a great device, but it's also changing the way we connect and the way we relate to each other.
There's nothing wrong with having a smartphone, but you need to be smart as to how much you use it. As a matter of fact, I took my son and a couple of his friends out to lunch, And we went to one of the famous Tex-Mex kinds of restaurants that kids seem to like. They eat that about 3 times a week. I can only eat about once every 3 months, you know, because of my age and my digestive system. And I said to them, when we walk into here, I want you to notice how many people are talking to each other and how many people are smiling. We walked in, there was a line that goes to the cafeteria-like assembly where people are putting together your preference food. There was about 50 tables that were full. Not one person was smiling. There was one family, all four were on their phones, but they were playing a game with each other on their phones. So that's not really the kind of game that I would think of from my generation. But you're absolutely correct. Everybody had a phone, and they were eyeing those phones. We see the same thing here. We see people going to have coffee together, whether it's 2 people or 4 people, and they're sitting there, they've ordered the coffee, but yet they're doing their own communications on their own phones rather than enjoying each other's company. You need to have the phones. You need to have television. You need to have radio. You need to have education. But there's also a time and a place for everything. And sometimes what you need to do is block out times to do the telephone, block out times to watch a show, block out times to listen to a show, block out times for your children. You know, you need to have this kind of a balance, because if you just leave it up in the air, you'll end up being hypnotized by these babysitters that are the media.
Hmm.
And there's nothing wrong with media, but don't just get hypnotized by it for nothing.
So if you're out on a date, if you're going out for dinner with your husband, your wife, your partner, do you take your phones with you? Are your phones at the table? Are you going on to social media? Wherever you're going, where are you going on your phone when you're with your partner? Let me know your thoughts on that. A message here saying, are humans really meant to be monogamous? There seems to be so many cases of infidelity that it sometimes makes me wonder if culture, society rules, religion have created a concept of infidelity when maybe we were always meant to have multiple relationships without having to feel the guilt. What do you think about that? Let me know your thoughts on 4001.
It's interesting that that topic has come up now, because we're learning a lot now more about neuropsychology and how this actually happens. What we're finding is that back in the old days, before we had the fMRIs and all that other stuff, we would look at things from behavioral processes, emotional processes, and the cognitive processes that we understood. We knew that when people have too much exposure to one thing, they become extinct of the anxiety and moral understanding of what's right or wrong. Now that we have more of the instrument that looks at brain functions, what we're finding is that when people view situations, when people are rehearsing situations in their head, there's something that's called brain plasticity. That means that even as we're talking with each other now, our brain structure is changing to absorb the information. But when that information is processed repetitively for hours on end or days on end, the brain will adapt. And the brain will adapt to that new sense of the topic, which means less ethics, less morals, maybe more aggression, because you now don't have a balance for that. So when we look at a person who's asking the question about guilt, the guilt begins to subside because of the overexposure to that situation that usually would have meant anxiety and guilt because of the moral development that you learn from your family, from your place of worship, or from the community at large. But when you're exposed too much to the wrongdoing, even in your brain now we know what happens. The brain adapts to not having to feel the guilt anymore. And therefore we're seeing a complete difference in people's understanding of morality. Their complete definition now has moved from the reason people get married is to procreate, to now the reason that people get married, even same-sex marriage, is to recreate. Well, those kind of differences now are starting to move as to what is considered immoral. If you're in love with a person, so what if they're married? Our love will prevail. We can still go to our place of worship and not have to feel guilty for what we're doing wrong, because it might not be wrong anymore. And we're finding the leadership within a lot of these progressive religious movements, we'll use that as an example, and even government's political stand and changes in the law to complement the changes that people are making because of overexposure. That would be my psychological explanation. But where's that going to lead us? Is it actually a healthy move that we're making, or is it going to be even more destructive to human understanding and human existence and human interrelationship as we've known it today?
Get involved in the conversation. Keep your messages coming in on 4001. What are your thoughts on this? And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation looking at infidelity and the perceptions between men and women. We're also going to be taking a look at parenting styles when it comes to raising young people today. And we want them to have self-esteem. We're told that means that they will be happier, more successful individuals, adults. But are we raising narcissists instead in today's world? So that's something we'll be talking about a little bit later. Stay with us. We started off today looking at infidelity and the perceptions, how they differ between men and women. We're asking you about the use of phones and the internet and where you go to and who you're connecting with. And if you're going out on a date, if you're going out with your partner, are you on your phones? And if you are, who are you talking to? Where are you going? What are you, who or what are you interacting with? And why aren't you looking at each other and talking to each other? People texting their thoughts on that, as well as about relationships and in this day and age defining what a relationship is for you. So one person says here, Dr. Raymond, relationships are all about a mutual understanding. Exclusivity is up to the couple to decide. So if one partner doesn't keep up their end of the bargain, it's then being disrespectful and maybe it's a betrayal. So is that what we're seeing today, Dr. Raymond? You meet many couples, you come across many individuals in your field as a psychologist. Are people creating new rules in their relationships?
There are new rules. Every couple does have a decision on how they will define their relationship. But it has to be mutual, and that's the key to success. It has to be mutual. There cannot be compromise. There cannot be accommodation, because that's a win-lose situation. It has to be cooperation. So before you even get married to that person, it's very helpful to do premarital workshop with a qualified professional that helps you understand your personality. It helps you understand each other's personalities. It helps you realize how your partner sees you, not just how you see your partner. Then you're going to look at conflict resolution with communications that are more effective to reach that cooperation. But then you'll also have an opportunity to define your marriage, even before it becomes a marriage. Many researchers today and many psychologists that have been doing domestic psychology for years will tell you that sometimes you can predict a divorce before the marriage even happens. Because when you look at the different personalities and they don't know each other, or they don't have the desire to cooperate, but they're living two independent lives under the same roof, and they're not in coordinates with that, it's going to, of course, lead to a divorce. There are also some people that have certain personality disorders that don't show up and until many, many years later. And it's not because of deliberate deception. It might be because of an inherited factor. And I'm not just talking about genetic. It could be the way they were raised in their home, the way they saw their parents interact, things that they thought it was okay to keep secret, might not be your agenda. It's not just, I came from a family of 12 and you're an only child, so how are we going to both fit into here? Because I'm used to having a lot of people at the dinner table. You're used to having your own plate of food. It can also be what's on your plate emotionally, the way you think, feel, and behave. So when you look at a relationship, you need to look at your personality and how you can complement. When we do relationship management for premarital couples, we're not looking at what's going to be wrong. We're looking at them to understand themselves, how they can make things right. We're not interested in people breaking up. We're interested in helping them be together for the right reason, how they can work together, how they can complement each other, how they can fulfill their own life without compromising the other person's life. So it becomes mutual. So the definition of a relationship is paramount. But to get there, know your personality, know your partner's personality, learn how the two of you will resolve conflicts. How do you want to express affection with each other? How do you want to deal with the finances with each other? How are you going to deal with the in-laws? What about the children? So there's many, many dimensions in looking at how to prevent problems by how to make problems good.
And how you feel about infidelity and what that means to you, how you define that within your, you know, within your value system. You mentioned there compromise. Someone here saying, is it okay to have a feeling of compromise after marriage? So you stay together, you don't break apart for the sake of the children. There are differences between the spouse, and one is suppressed under the thinking wishes of the other without being outspoken about it, just keeping the relationship going. So that idea of staying together because of the children, feeling that you can't speak out, you can't talk about your sense of dissatisfaction or that feeling that you're, you know, relationships are all about compromise. But if you're feeling like it's a compromise in a negative way, that has to be addressed.
People should never divorce as a first option unless there's clear abuse, unless there are clear destructive mechanisms taking place, and the person who is a perpetrator of the destruction is refusing to acknowledge or get help. Divorce should only be recognized then as the first option. Divorce should be the last option. And the reason is because when two people decide to get married, they're getting married on good faith. That should be the indication. They're not getting married to make life perfect, but they're getting married to, when things do happen, they can perfect things. They can enjoy life. They can grow old together. When you're staying together for the children, that's a distraction from what you need to be doing on working on the marriage. And as I mentioned in the earlier hour, children are perceptive to your distress in the marriage. Even if you're both good parents, you're both good parents individually, but you're not good people to each other as husband and wife. It's the husband and wife, it's the marriage that is the foundation of the relationship, not good parenting. Good parenting is a positive aspect, but the children need to have that foundation of the family unit, which is husband and wife are together, and they happen to be mom and dad for me as well. When that is in order, children are more comfortable. Staying together for the sake of the children builds up resentment in the children because they're feeling guilty for your unhappiness. They feel that they're responsible for your unhappiness. You're going to be happy if I wasn't here? You don't want me as a child? Don't you wish that I was never born so you could go off and be happy? You don't want your children thinking that. To make your children comfortable in the home, work on your marriage. To make your children understand what a good relationship is, work on your marriage. No relationship has ever been perfect. So when your children see you correcting the problems, when your children see you reaching resolution with each other, that's when they learn how to have a better relationship themselves. Because one of the things you can be assured is your children are going to repeat exactly what you did when they grow up and have a relationship.
So if you, one of the issues has been that one of the partners has been unfaithful, there's been an affair, there's been adultery, should you tell the children about that?
The answer right off the bat is no. That's a husband and wife issue. It's not a mom and dad situation. However, if the community knows about it, the children need to be aware that there are things that are being said that they might learn, and they would need to hear it from you first. They also need to know how you're resolving it and how you're going to stay together or not stay together. They need to know that reality. But my work and my experience with a lot of families with children of different ages, they don't need to know that because it's very destructive for them, because an affair is not just against your partner, it's against the children as well because they've been betrayed. Dad is not supposed to have another friend that takes mom's place. Mom's not supposed to have a friend that takes dad's place. Even though they might say, well, they don't take your place, it's still betrayal. It's still deception. It's confusing for children. Mom and dad are supposed to be together. And the question that came earlier about monogamy, we are a monogamous breed. Even when the research says men aren't, give me a break. There's liars, damn liars, and statisticians. They weren't talking to the men who I know. And I know quite a bit of men who are not interested in betrayal. It's not just women who are loyal to a relationship. It's men, too. You know, at one time, it was believed back in the 30s, if men showed sensitivity to the aesthetics, that may have meant that they had homosexual tendencies. That was so wrong. What is realized is that the more educated men are, the more exposed they are to the fine arts, the more broader they are, and they don't have to have effeminate characteristics or wrongful sexual inclinations, if you want to call it wrongful. Well, the same thing today. If men are sensitive to a relationship, that doesn't mean that they're sissies or that they're bisexual or have any problems. It just means that they're maturing, that they're realizing that two people support each other. They love each other mutually, they care for each other mutually, and they share life together.
A message here, Dr. Raymond, for you. My brother suffers, or I don't know the right word, but he can't be in just one relationship. He controls his partners by using his anger and aggressive behavior. I'd like to help him, and sometimes I'd like to help those girls as well, but the brother code comes in and takes a hold of me. So please share your thoughts on what to do, or is it okay for me to talk to his girlfriends behind his back? As his brother, is that ethical?
There may be a lot of disorders going on with your brother. Personality disorders. There could be a lot of insecurities. I'm not trying to guess what it could be because I don't know your brother and it wouldn't be fair to do that. However, my concern when I hear these kinds of symptoms coming up, and that means unable to stay in a commitment relationship, anger, aggression, very abusive things are happening. And this is an anger management situation that needs to be looked at very seriously. What I also want to tell you, though, is sometimes depression can bring these kinds of stories into play. So when we're looking at depression, it's not just feeling sad and blue. Sometimes depression can be so severe, it shows agitation, irritation, irresponsibility, aggression. You know, sometimes that can be the depression. The person needs to have this addressed. If you're needing to deal with the girlfriends in this situation, you have to ask yourself, what is the purpose? Are you angry with your brother and you want to make his life miserable? Or are you using this as a way to get him into treatment? Don't go into that direction telling the girlfriends whether it's ethical or not. It's up to you. My recommendation is you got to get your brother help. And your brother needs help that might require family support. So it might not just be you. It might be mom and dad if they're still living. And the other siblings who take the brother and say, here's what our concern is. We have an appointment now at this clinic with a specialist who's going to help us all. And we're going to go to that appointment. And I would do it very, very quickly. Soon to the appointment. Don't wait 2 weeks. But it could be even the same day. You just say 2 o'clock today, we're all going to this appointment. I don't know your brother to know if that's going to be the best thing to do or giving him a couple of days to let it soak in. But usually in these kind of things that are being described in this short SMS, it's usually you have to strike while the iron is hot. So make the appointment, but don't tell him until the day of the appointment, and go as a family. This is a tough love kind of an approach. It's a milder form of tough love, but it's a good approach because it shows support. You're not going to throw him out on the street because he misbehaves. You want to know why. Matter of fact, it's amazing how much I've had opportunities to work with people from different parts of the world with different situations. I had a very similar situation to this show up of a young man, happily married, beautiful children, loved his family. One morning he wakes up and starts misbehaving. Literally, one morning he wakes up and starts misbehaving. He is a couch potato. If somebody says, let's go play golf, he jumps up. If his wife asks him to help with the kids, he doesn't want to have anything to do with it. The reason that it looked unusual is because there was no prelude to this. So after working with this person and his wife for a couple of sessions, I said, why don't we get a neuropsychiatrist or a neurologist or a neuropsychologist into the picture here? To make a long story short, we didn't have that variety of specialists in the country at that time. This was back in the mid-90s. So I had him see this psychiatrist who I was working with, very learned man. He happened to be from the old school. He was both a neurologist and a psychiatrist. Sure enough, there was a pinhead tumor that had manifested all of a sudden. And the reason we knew it was Pinhead, it wasn't showing on x-rays, sonograms, or anything like that. The fMRI had just come out, and they actually were able to ship him back to his home of origin to get that kind of an assessment done. And it was actually a pinhead tumor that was lodged in a location that would cause this kind of misbehavior. Now, it's usually in the midbrain area. There was not the sophistications then of laser, but there was a surgical procedure that could actually help with a very, very specialized hospital that would be able to do this kind of neurosurgical element. Once that happened, they were able to get rid of the tumor. Within several weeks, things started going back to normal. So I'm not making up excuses to tell you this is a tumor. I'm not going to tell you that this is epileptic, a temporal epileptic behavior. Nothing like that at all. I'm telling you that there could be many reasons for this, but it needs to be discovered with family support. That is paramount to him being able to recover.
I think it's interesting you describe these as symptoms, and that's something that people can look at, you know, if behavior's changing or you're seeing different behaviors with your partner and what it might mean. When we're looking in this situation, just we don't know the individual, but just picking up on some of those words, things like you said, you know, aggressive behavior, anger, can't stay in one relationship, he's got two or three different girls on the go at the same time, control. This sounds like somebody that doesn't like women very much, in the sense that how those women would feel if they knew they were being treated in such a way. And that's another part of it, is understand. It's going to be both ways. It could be from a man to a woman or a woman to a man. But your understanding of relationships and why you need a relationship, or you use people or have people in your life, what is it that you're patching over? What is it that your pain, you're actually hurting from? Or why is it that you would treat people with such little respect?
That aggression is very concerning, though, and that's why I took the route in explaining my understanding of it in that direction. There are many people who don't like women because of their own history. There are women who don't like men because of their own history. But they don't necessarily have to be aggressive, controlling, devious. They can play a passive-aggressive part, being implosive or explosive in a relationship. That would be usually the characteristics that you would see when men have difficulty with women or women have difficulty with men. But when I saw the words of aggression, control, and not being able to have just one relationship, and it's open, obviously, about it, to the brother, he knows about it, that began to concern me. It alarmed me as to what else might be going on. That's more than just, I had a bad experience when I was growing up with family members or other people in my life, and I don't trust women or I don't trust men.
Well, it just goes to show, isn't it, the minefield that is the mind and how psychologists play their role. Now, looking here, somebody's saying when it comes to, we were talking earlier about, is it okay to look at your partner's phone or look at internet history, monogamous relationships or not? And this person says, you know, as long as someone isn't caught. But in his case, he was caught, and he was saying, my wife caught me whilst she was having a sneaky look at my phone. But we've now got over it, and we are living happily. So there's encouragement in the sense that we're not saying it's okay to do this, but you can recover from an infidelity or a deception within a relationship.
Well, when people get caught, of course, psychologists, especially those of us that are analytically trained, will ask, did you deliberately do that? And deliberately could mean unconsciously, did you want to get caught? Being in an affair or considering one is very uncomfortable. It's lying. It's not just denying, it's actually lying. It is deception, it is betrayal. And usually the person, unless they're a psychopath, are going to feel a lot of that anxiety. And they may be wanting to find a way out. It might also be a message to their partner, our marriage is in trouble. We need to work on it. Would you just please listen to what I'm trying to tell you? And if you don't listen, then I have to come up with a scenario that's going to jar you into listening. Now, we're getting into more of the psychoanalytic understanding of relationships and the dynamics, but who's to say that doesn't work? You do want to learn about your marriage being in trouble in a different way. But if you've tried different ways, and that's the only way that your partner can get your attention, rather than just being angry, yes, of course, it's normal to be angry. But look at, what are we doing that makes this marriage difficult? Many times we ask people who have been betrayed, where they're victims of that kind of an abusive content in the relationship, Have you ever asked yourself, what did you do that caused your partner to have an affair? Now, a lot of people don't like that statement because they say, well, you're going to blame me for what they did. And that's not the point. As psychologists, we're wanting to help people understand themselves and how they support each other, negative support or positive support. How do they get to the point where they both are today? So not lawyers, but psychologists would say, both of you are responsible for where you are today. What role did you play that would have gotten your partner to do what they did? And have you not ever been vulnerable?
Social media, is that playing a part in the increase in divorce? Looking at an article from the National Newspaper in August 2015, written by Aisha Al-Mazruri, social media has been increasingly blamed for marital disputes and divorce, not only in the UAE, but around the world. A recent US study published in the journal Computers in Human Behavior found a link between social media use and decreased marriage satisfaction. Researchers found that the use of social network sites is negatively correlated with marriage quality and happiness, and positively correlated with experiencing a troubled relationship and contemplating divorce. We'll look at this a little bit more when we come back. Now, Dr. Raymond, as a psychologist, you've been in the profession for many years. Is there a rise in narcissists, or is it just that we've become more aware of the term and understanding of it, that we are now identifying people as narcissists more than ever before?
It may be a little bit of both, but let's look at narcissism as a disease, as a disorder. And it is very destructive. But we also know that we can take these destructive characteristics and put them into a productive mode. And a productive mode means that you take that person's characteristics and put it in a way that will also be advantageous to leading a company, leading a troop of soldiers, handling negotiations. Some of the best negotiators of narcissistic personality disorders are those who have narcissistic personality disorders when they have a better venue. In other words, when you take them out of the destructive environment and you put them into a productive environment, their narcissism actually can be controlled. It can be managed, whether it's a religious order, whether it's a business order, whether it's military order. Any of these can set up a platform. In other words, what you have when you have a religious order or a political order or a military order or a business order, you have a framework that's called an infrastructure that sets the rules and regulations. When that person who we are calling a personality disorder, whether they're narcissist, histrionic, antisocial personality, are put into that kind of an order and they are appreciative of that, it gives them that control that they need. We've had people in the ministry of whatever religion it might be, who needed to be in the ministry to control impulses. In psychoanalytic terms, this is called reaction formation, where you go into a profession that controls your impulse. Now, a lot of people argue that doesn't sound nice. Well, it isn't nice to say it, but the fact is, that's how people manage their impulses. What we're seeing today also that's important to remember is that with less parental guidance and more untamed, unsupervised viewing of television, movies that are making their money from profanity, from aggression, from violence of any sort and misconceived kinds of processes, you're encouraging children to go in that direction because, especially at a young age, when they're supposed to be learning moral development, ethical development, if it's not there, they're not going to get it later necessarily.
And understanding their sense of self and how their sense of self is perceived. Now, looking at this article in Psychology Today, they say proper care and feeding of children's emerging sense of self puts them on the path towards healthy self-esteem. And things like great job and you're the best, there are subtle differences there. So telling your child good job, well done, as opposed to saying you're the best and you're better than everybody else.
Yeah, you're the best, you're better than anybody else certainly does provoke that narcissistic characteristic. It's kind of also like you're so intelligent, you're going to do great on the test. Well, what if they don't do great on the test? That's not positive psychology, as many people misinterpret. Positive psychology that teaches self-esteem building for the right reason is when you learn how to study correctly, you'll learn the information better, and you'll perform better on the test that are indicators on how much you know. That means that when you put the effort, you're showing value, you're showing self-worth, and you'll get the results from it.
It's a fascinating area. Just let's go to the messages, Dr. Raymond. I'm rapidly running out of time, but somebody here is saying, I'm a regular listener and respect your work. I don't feel myself at peace ever because of social media. I work in the industry. I feel like social media is being imposed on me at work, professionally, things like WhatsApp groups, which means now that you are accessible 24/7 when you hear that buzz coming through your phone. And it's the idea that you can't miss it. You've got to respond to it immediately. You've got to reply all the time. I don't want to use it, but I can't stop because of my job. I have to. So what should I do? And I feel like I'm suffering a lot with anxiety over this.
Yeah, this is usually because it sounds like he's getting to burnout, frankly. And burnout is when you get beyond stress. And burnout is when it's difficult to be rational, it's difficult making decisions. You're feeling fatigued, you don't sleep well. It's difficult to focus a lot of times. So the anxiety can manifest itself in different ways. It can also bring on sense of depression to the point where some people have gotten so bad with their burnout, they reach what's called acute psychotic episode, where they actually have to be hospitalized, medicated. It's a very short process of time, and then they're back to what's normal again. The remedy for this situation is that you do need to have limits. You can't be working 24/7. The brain can't handle it. It's no different than going into the gym. You can't work 2 hours straight with weights without taking a break. Well, the brain is like a muscle. It has to take breaks. You may want to turn off your phone from 8 o'clock at night until 8 o'clock in the morning, as one of my physician friends was telling me just yesterday what he does. Because you have to have a break. No matter what your profession is, you need to have time for yourself. You need to have time for work, time for play, time for relationships, and spiritual time as well.
Another message here saying, my boss is a supreme narcissist. One of his character traits is to have multiple affairs. I've known him for over 20 years and he's always been the same. He's now having an affair with my colleague who is also a narcissist, and it is hell for all of us at work.
Well, they deserve each other then, don't they? I guess, but I'm just being naughtily funny there. It's unfortunate that these kind of situations happen, and one of the things I was saying earlier is if you take a narcissist or any personality and you put them in a place where they can be productive rather than destructive, there's actually benefit from that. Whether they're leading an organization, leading a military, or whatever their leadership role is, where they can take their intelligence and their way of knowing how to manipulate and not exploit, but learning how to encourage rather than devastate people. In this situation, unfortunately, you got what you're calling a narcissist. I don't know if they are or not, but from what you're calling a narcissist, they're in a destructive mode. And this is dangerous for the company, not just for them and their narcissist partner, as you're pointing out. It can be very dangerous for the company. And this is where the board of directors or the trustees need to come into this picture and correct it. If he owns the company, you might need to think about getting out.
Because in some cases, there's just not a lot you can do. And it's a really unfortunate situation to find yourself in. But it could be that you just have to remove yourself from people like that.
Yeah, you don't go to a narcissist and say, I think you're narcissistic. No. Why don't you get some help?
No. Well, Dr. Raymond, as always, thank you very much for your time. And it's great having you in the chair again. It's been a while. And, of course, we'll connect with Dr. Raymond all the time. We've posted up on our Dubai Today blog post today information of the Human Relations Institute and clinics where you can connect with Dr. Raymond and his team. And you'll be back with me again in the chair in September.
We're looking forward to that.
Indeed.
Sure.
And safe travels to you.
Thank you very much. I look forward to be back. As a matter of fact, the book will be published, Balance for Life Before Burnout. And I was very grateful to Sheikh Ahmed bin Said, who wrote the foreword to this book, and hopefully we'll have a grand opening in that and a book signing. So hopefully everybody will be here for that too.
I look forward to that very, very much indeed.